Welcome to Horror Movie Yearbook. I am Willie.
I'm Tim, and I'm adjusting my microphone.
Yes, that's Tim, bumping in the night over there.
Yeah, sorry about that. If that like blew your ears out.
It's all right. Hey, welcome to the latest in our lovely September of the Dead special series we're doing. We hope you guys enjoyed our Night and Dawn discussions. You'll be joining us tonight for Day of the Dead, or today. I don't know what time you're listening to this, but we're recording at night, so... but you might be watching during the Day of the Dead.
I had never... This is going to sound insane to you.
Sure.
I had never noticed the Day of the Dead poster, what the two pictures were supposed to be in.
So yeah, so there's a handful of Day of the Dead posters. There's some really good ones. My favorite is, I think it's just the straight up original promotional poster.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, first there was Night of the Living Dead, then Dawn of the Dead, and then it's boom. And it's a very cool poster. We can take a picture and put it on Instagram. I've got it on down here, a little mini version of it. So
I was working my way through the Scream Factory Day of the Dead D Blu-ray,
which is excellent, by the
way. And they put on the you can scroll through, of course, photo galleries, and they put on kind of promotional material. And I was looking at it, and I was sitting there going, I have never noticed that it's supposed to be night in the background, then dawn, then day.
And it's kind of cool.
It flew by.
Because night, it looks like black and white, you know, because it's just the moon on the black sky. And then dawn has this bluish and orange hue that kind of fits the color palette of that movie a little bit.
Yep.
I dig it. And then you've got, I guess, I don't know who that zombie's supposed to be on the cover. Rarely are they actually zombies in the movie that are on the covers, but I actually kind of looks like the Dawn zombie from the Dawn cover with the half his face blown off or whatever it is. So
right.
I don't know. Maybe he's the same one. He just shows up for the promotional materials.
Are we going to be talking about, no, not in this episode. In one of the next episodes, we'll be talking about reappearing zombies.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We will have a zombie that will be popping back up, which is fun.
Yeah.
So, hey, before we get into it, we've been doing a bit of a, not a contest per se, but a giveaway. We're having folks enter in brackets about the first four George Romero Dead movies, the ones that we're covering in length, pitting them against each other in a bracket format. And for people who are sending their finished brackets or even just their winner, we like finished brackets, though.
Finished brackets, yeah. Actually, most of the entries you've had have been awesome at finishing brackets. But we'll even accept picks, really.
Yeah, that would be okay, too.
Yeah.
But we are going to be doing our first of two drawings this time on in our September of the Dead series. This will be a drawing for a hardcover copy of George A. Romero and Daniel Krause's excellent novel, The Living Dead, which is kind of a, I don't want to say continuation, because none of these movies are really continuations per se, but it really is kind of the final chapter in Romero's Dead saga that he, thanks to the help of fantastic author Daniel Krause, was able to get completed and finished and released after Romero's passing. So we're giving away a hardcover, and please feel free to continue sending in brackets if you have not already, because a couple episodes from now, when we cover the actual book itself, we'll be giving away a paperback version, or a soft cover version. It's not a paperback, it's a soft cover version, I should say. Still nice, big, thick, beastly cover, cool. Beastly copy. We'll be giving that away as well. So I think the way we're going to do this is we're going to draw a name. Tim is drawing out of
No. Let's explain to the people what I have in front of me. Are these people a sponsor?
No, they are not. So maybe
not
I should talk to them.
You know what we should do? We should do an It's Alive tie-in with what we have here. Because explain to them what I'm looking at right now.
Tim is looking, looking into the gaping chasm that is a toddler potty. little plastic deal that they sit on and do their business when you're trying to potty train them. Because generally toddlers are afraid of toilets, including mine.
Still afraid, personally still afraid of toilets because of one time I saw a toilet snake.
Oh, okay. That's terrifying.
Freaks me out.
I thought you were going to say ghoulies, but...
that would have been more fitting. Both horrifying in their own way.
Truly.
Especially because the ghoulies go to college.
They do.
At some point.
Yeah. One of them has a diploma in his hand on the cover.
And if you've seen colleges lately, there's nothing scarier in America right now.
It's true. It's very true. So no, we thought it'd be funny too. This this toddler potty has not been used, by the way.
Yeah.
But it's just funny.
Or so I've been told, yes.
Yes, she has not. She's sat on it with pants on. Okay. So she's very excited about it, and we're very excited about it, clearly, because we're using it to draw names out of. So,
yes.
Timmy, if you want to shake that toddler potty up a little bit first,
okay.
Give it a shake.
Is the gooey inside going to be okay?
He'll be fine. Okay. He'll be all right. Yep, let's see. All right.
As you can hear, I'm giving it a shake.
A good shaking, yeah. Yes.
All right, so.
We're pulling a name out. So this will be the winner of the hardcover copy of The Living Dead. Now, I think what we're going to do is
mix it around a little bit.
We'll
too.
Be adding any new names, that any new brackets we get from now until the time we do a second drawing.
Yes.
And I think we'll be keeping the rest of the names in here as well. So,
of course,
if you've sent in the bracket before, you're covered for a second drawing if you don't win it this time. Just a heads up.
This is exciting stuff.
This is exciting stuff, yes.
All right.
Tim has pulled a name out, and we'll see what we got going on here. Who is the winner of the
copy? Tom!
Tom is the winner.
Tom Zimney, I believe.
Yes.
Tom, who got us his bracket on Instagram.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yes. So, Tom Zimney, you are the big winner.
Yes.
We will find a way to reach out to you.
Very fitting, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. Tom's from the East Coast. He may even be from the Pennsylvania area.
Oh, beautiful.
So this is perfect.
Beautiful.
With George Romero.
Yeah, reach out to us. We'll reach out to you, and we'll get your details, your deets, as the kids say, and get that shipped out to you as soon as we can here. So
let's, real quick, let's take a look at Tom's bracket.
Yeah, I would love to.
While we're at it, we'll go over everybody's at some point after we're done, but we're going to go with the first winning bracket. This is from Tom. Tom's got dawn over land, he's got night over day, and then he has night over dawn. So he's got Night of the Living Dead winning it all.
Tom. Fantastic.
Yep.
Most excellent. Awesome. Thanks again, everyone, for sending those in, and thank you, Tom, for
put the potty back
for sending
on.
Yours in as well. Yes, the potty has been used. We are good to go with the potty. fantastic. So we will be we're doing another drawing. Send those brackets in if you haven't already. You still have a chance to win a copy of the book. It's well worth a read. Well worth throwing a bracket out there. Only four movies. We won't take up too much of your time here. So, but you can do that. You can email us horrormovieyearbook@gmail.com. We're on Twitter @HMYearbook. You can find us on Facebook, Horror Movie Yearbook, on Instagram, Horror Movie Yearbook. So find us on one of those methods of contact. Get a hold of us. Send us a bracket or a list of winners. People even had put graphics in some of their brackets. It was impressive.
Oh, that was impressive stuff. Yeah,
that was excellent stuff. Yeah. A couple on Twitter had some really cool, well put together brackets. So anyway. Thanks, guys, for sending those in, and your chances aren't over yet.
And we've had quite a few entrants so far. So
yeah, pretty excited about it.
Yes.
Tim, we are headed back to 1985. You got a time machine sound for us this time around.
Ooh,
I like that.
Yeah, okay. I tried to throw a little bit of Caribbean flavor in for the score to Day of the Dead.
Oh, we'll be talking about the score a lot, I think.
just a heads up. Yeah, when I was listening to the commentaries on those Scream Factory, I turned off Roger Avery, the writer of Pulp Fiction. He said, I like everything about this movie. It's my favorite except for the score. And I said, nope, I'm done with this one.
Hold on a second. This is why we make such great pals and co-hosts, because I turned on the Roger Avery commentary to Day of the Dead, and he said, the score sucks, and I went, nope, and I turned it off. So we literally had the exact same experience, separately.
Just so you know, this is a podcast. Anytime we hear something we disagree with, we will immediately shut it off.
No, you know what, though? I'm not afraid of talking smack about Roger Avery. That's fine.
Yeah.
He doesn't listen, I don't think. But he also was annoying me because he kept going on about, like, in my own film, such and such, I blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no one wants to talk to you.
Yeah, the way he introduced himself is like, I'm the director of Killing Zoe and Rules of Attraction, a movie which I loved, by the way.
I haven't watched it in a long time. I did not, but I went and saw it in the theater, and my friend that I went with was made out with his girlfriend the whole time next to me, and it was gross sounding. And kind of ruined the movie for me.
Kind of sounded like a Romero zombie.
Snacking away.
Snacking
right, exactly. Anyway, so we're back in 85. Tim, you're a year old. I am not born yet. I think I am, I believe at the time of Day's release. Day was released when, let's see, it was. When was it released in the States? July 19th of 85. So, yeah, I was probably in the works at this point in time, but I did not exist yet. So,
were you conceived during Day?
I'm horrible at this, right? I have a kid and I'm horrible at this.
Yeah.
So I was born in March of 86. So would my mother have been with child at that point? Does that make sense? God, why am I so bad at this? So
it would have been five. No, it would have been six. You would have been June, I believe, would have been around the...
Okay.
Yeah, if you were a nine-month pregnancy.
Yeah, which I was. Yeah.
So you would have been... They probably saw... You were probably conceived during an advertisement.
I know where I was conceived.
We don't need to go too far into this.
It was at a concert. You want to know who it was, right?
You may have told me this before, but you can
Adam
tell
everybody. Adam Ant.
Adam Ant. That's right. Yeah.
Yes, I was conceived in Adam Ant, supposedly. Well, I don't know how they figured that out, but whatever. Let's move on. 85.
I know I was going to start quizzing. I was gonna start asking questions.
I don't know any more details.
So 85. So here's the thing with 85. I was one year old at this point. You were not born. The Adam Ant concert may have happened. We don't know.
Yeah, we're not good with that.
We don't have the dates in front of us.
No.
So we like to go through and provide context for the years and talk about the news and stuff. But honestly, I don't. I was like, first of all, I don't think this has a lot. This movie, I never take much from it as far as maybe Romero's a very political filmmaker.
Sure.
But I personally don't take a lot from Day politically. Or socially, maybe even at the time, more of what I take from Day is philosophical.
Sure,
yeah,
it's more philosophical, I think, certainly than Night and Dawn. Right?
Yes,
I do think there's a little bit going on there that Romero has said certainly up front his intentions behind it, and we'll talk about that a little bit.
The script the original script is very political.
Yeah, let's touch on that for a second before we get into the movie proper. So we both read I've read it before. I think it's your first, maybe second time reading it.
First time reading it, yeah. I had read articles about it and read summaries of
course.
It. And you've told me about it.
It was one of those like horror movie urban legends, right? Everybody knew it was out there. Eventually, it was pretty readily available on the internet. It was one of the first scripts I read on the internet, and I remember thinking, "Wow, it's kind of cool. You can read scripts." Romero's original vision for Day was much bigger in scope, certainly. Lots of intelligent zombies and this island fortress and this kind of rich local politician that set up shop on this island, and there were explosions and boats and helicopters. I mean, it was big.
It's this big, and it's like this big class struggle too.
Yeah, very big in its ideas.
Yes.
And a lot of these ideas he would revisit in Land, and you can see a lot of that in Land. When we talk about Land, we'll get into that. But basically, the background of that is that Romero. Signed a three-picture deal with these producers, and the only catch was that one of the films had to be a sequel to Dawn. That was the big thing. Well, it couldn't be a direct sequel because of the rights issues, but it had to be another zombie movie in Romero's universe. And so, smartly, he figured, well, I'm going to make that the third movie because then I've got him on the hook for the first two. If something goes wrong with the first one, I can, you know, like, they got to wait, you know. Very smart, really kind of a very guerrilla filmmaker of Romero to think that way and very intelligent. And so he made the first couple movies. I believe the first two movies were Knight Riders and Creepshow.
It was Knight Riders, Creepshow, yep.
And when it came around today, they took a look at the script and said it was going to be a $7 million movie, mm-hmm. which is was big money for that type of movie back then. And the producers, I believe, basically said, we're not going to give you $7 million unless we can get a rated R, because unrated at that time was essentially an X rating. It couldn't be advertised in papers the way most movies could. Some newspapers wouldn't do any advertising for it. Obviously, you'd have a smaller audience being able to see it. So he said, "We'll do it. We'll do an unrated, but you got to cut that budget in half, essentially 3.5" And so he went back and retooled the script, and we got the Day that we all know now. And that's the reason why you see a big difference between the original script and the finished film. Now, I would implore, I think you and I both agreed we're happier overall with what the film became.
And Romero has, I believe in the documentary that's included on Day of the Dead, he makes sure to mention that he's happier with the way, because he says it distilled it down to its essence, essentially.
Yes.
What he, kind of the big ideas he was going for in the original script, he kind of distilled down to them. And one of the funny thing is it's a smart way to do it, but I think he mentions this also in the documentary, by the time, or it's one of his cohorts, by the time they got to actually produce day, that pool of money may have dried up a little bit.
Yeah.
So they weren't able to, because Knight Rider's kind of underwhelmed.
Yes.
And
Creepshow did okay.
Creepshow did okay, but neither one of them were like runaway successes. That by the time it got to day, day's kind of pool of that three picture deal, that money had kind of run out and the well had run dry a little bit.
And so, then you add the rating issue too.
Yes.
And it just, yeah.
But yeah, Romero has called this his favorite.
Mm-hmm. I think he stuck to those guns pretty much until he passed.
Yeah,
his second favorite, he said, was Survival.
Yes, which I am going to revisit those last two now after watching these four, because I found stuff to, I found stuff that applies to today in all of these movies.
Sure.
And I'm interested to see if I find that in Diary and Survival a little more this time. Because he really does, he seems to like Survival a lot. So, interested to see that. So, real quick though, I want to touch on one of the other reasons. So this was everybody, that script too, had the rumors around it had gotten into the kind of horror zeitgeist at the time. It had gotten into Fangoria. Fangoria had talked about that original script and the ideas that were present in it, a lot of it.
Well worth a read, by the way.
Yes.
It's readily available online. Basically, you Google Day of the Dead script, you can find it. It's out there. Totally check it out. It's I like Romero's scripts. They're very readable. He doesn't write scripts like a lot of screenwriters do. They're a lot more descriptive and a lot more like reading a book or a short story. It feels a lot more like that. You get a lot more out of the universe, I think, than a lot of screenplays. So it's worth checking out. I think it really is worth checking out for sure.
Yeah, so So the details of this had gotten out into magazines like Fangoria. So fans had this idea in their head of what they were getting. And it was kind of this big sweeping, I think he even called it, a Gone with the Wind
style? Yeah, and I think Savini's referred to
zombie.
As the Ben-Hur with zombies.
Zombie.
Well, and I should say, I think that the script, the unproduced script, is certainly more of a sequel to Dawn, right? In terms of its tone.
Yes.
It gets bigger and crazier, than more comic book than Dawn it does.
Yes.
I would argue.
And like we said, that political aspect is there, whereas
it's
there, but it's not geared towards, because he's very much critiquing consumerism again in that script.
And the class stuff.
And
too.
The class stuff, very much so. And the mid-80s, around that time, kind of a lot of the big, Lifestyles of the Rich and the Famous was on TV.
Right.
Stuff like that was all over TV, and stuff like that was in people's face. And that's kind of the stuff he's going for with a lot of,
For sure. And
a lot of his ideas.
I honestly think, before we move on, that original script, I think at the time it would have been, if that had been the movie that was put out there, it would have been better received when it came out than the version we got. Now, the version we got, the finished Day of the Dead, it has since gained a much bigger following and a kind of a reappraisal and a reappreciation, the same way a lot of Carpenter's movies have. But I think that, I don't know that over time, that Day script, that finished Day film, would have held up the way that this one does, because it would have felt so similar to Dawn in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That's my thought. So
the other thing I want to touch on too is, I'm glad you brought up Carpenter, because there's a similarity to one of Carpenter's movies here. So I didn't want to go over the news so much. I wanted to go over the movie climate that this movie was released in 1985.
Right.
Because here's how the 80s start. The number one movie in 1980 was Empire Strikes Back. 81 was Raiders of Lost Ark. 82 was E.T., which came out the same year as The Thing, which is a movie that Day of the Dead shares a lot in common with in terms of reception. And then 83 is Jedi. Here's where 84 and 85. So here are the type of movies that are coming out around the time he's filming and releasing Day of the Dead.
Okay.
Ghostbusters, Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Karate Kid, Police Academy, Footloose, Beverly Hills Cop, Star Trek III, Terms of Endearment. Oh, that's a weird one. This is the top 10 of 84.
Sure.
Romancing the Stone, Splash, Purple Rain. So those are like the top movies of 1984.
Those are big, happy, fun, celebratory 80s type movies for the most part, right? Crowd pleasers. Real crowd pleasers.
And so here's what it was released in 85. Here's what we have here.
Man.
Back to the Future. Beverly Hills Cop again was in the top. That was a phenomenon. Rambo First Blood Part 2, Rocky 4, which is funny because both of those movies are very rah-rah, jingoistic, USA movies, and Day is not.
No.
No, Cocoon, The Goonies, Police Academy 2, and Fletch. So yeah, it's a lot of kind of lighthearted romp. Everybody's in a good mood in the mid-80s when it comes to their entertainment choices.
Yes.
And Day of the Dead is a movie that is not in a good mood at all. And it's reminiscent. It reminded me a lot of what happened to The Thing, which is got released the same year as E.T., and Day comes out the same way,
yep.
And it's being compared to Dawn, and it's being compared to what people, horror fans, had thought was coming out with that, the stuff that leaked and was public knowledge of the Day script that had they had talked about. So it's all of these things, and so that's why you get a very underwhelming response, I think, from a lot of horror fans at the time. They didn't go see it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he even says that. And
Dan, we got to remember, this is the same year that Return of the Living Dead came out.
Yes.
And Return of the Living Dead is like the 80s zombie movie. It's a romp. And it kind of fits alongside movies like Karate Kid and Beverly Hills Cop and like fun 80s movies, right? This is not that. So I can totally see why it was received the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Before we move into kind of dissecting the movie a bit, no pun intended, what was your first Day of the Dead experience?
So this is the other thing too, because this was kind of the weird one for me. I'm trying to remember exactly when I saw it. It would have been after I saw Night and Dawn.
Okay.
And
so you saw them probably in order then of, yeah.
I think so, but I'm not 100% sure on this because I may have caught Day after I caught Land. Because Land came out in 2005.
Yeah. Sure.
The problem with Day was it wasn't readily available at my video store.
Right.
So it was always kind of the weird one. There's always that weird one in a series, like Friday the 13th.
The missing piece. Yeah.
Yeah. back in the days before streaming,
yeah.
Like, and you could just search for something and pay $4 to rent it. Like, I was at the mercy of the two video stores in northern Michigan.
Yeah.
In the hometown I was in. And I don't believe either one of them had a copy of Day. Of course they had Night, because you could find a copy of Night anywhere. And and I believe they had Dawn as well. But yeah, Day was not readily available, so I believe I saw Day even after Land. I think Day was down the road.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So I shared my story last time about getting my Dawn VHS Christmas Day, not realizing that there was a sequel to Night, having been so obsessed with Night and being so excited to learn there was a sequel. Now, even after Dawn came out, I still didn't know there was a third. I was unaware that existed. By this point, I knew who Romero was. I had seen Creepshow. I had kind of an idea. And it's not the first time this wonderful, beautiful mecca of Berkeley, Michigan has been brought up on this show. But it's going to be brought up again here. Bally's Video Superstore. That was my local video store. There were two video stores in Berkeley. And that was my place. The only Romero movie they had was Day. That was it. And so when we started going in there regularly, sure enough, not long after we started going there, I went, oh, wait, what? I looked at it and I go, Day of the Dead, like Dawn of the Dead? And I flip it over and sure enough, George Romero. And I was like, oh my God, like there was no internet in my house at this point in time. You got to keep, it's tough, I think, sometimes for people that even folks like us, like who did live pre-internet,
mm-hmm.
It's hard for us to remember, I think, sometimes what it's like before the internet, right? But this was pretty, so I couldn't do the research and find out all the movies George Romero had made. I just didn't, how would I do that? I just, you know, I was a kid. But I saw this and I went, oh my God, this is like the next one. So I rented that copy of Day of the Dead from Bally's. I can't even begin to tell you how many times.
Yeah.
I remember at some point the clerk at Bally's was like, you're like the only person that's ever rented this.
So the other,
like,
yeah.
And I rented it a lot. And one of my deepest regrets is not when they had their going out of business sale, not going in and getting that VHS copy. That will forever haunt me that I wasn't able to get that specific copy that I think I ran to the ground.
I want to ask you this real quick. What was your go-to? Did you have a go-to like horror movie review site? I had two.
When they first started.
Yeah, like early days of we're waxing nostalgic about the early days of the internet, which is how old we are. But.
No, I didn't, actually. I just kind of went for it.
I had two. I had the Video Graveyard. Did you ever visit the Video Graveyard?
No.
And then I had Arrow in the Head.
I remember Arrow in the Head.
Arrow in the Head was like a offshoot of Joblo.com.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I think they're still around. They're still out there. And The other thing was, the other reason, like, I knew it existed, but it was those two reviewers, like, when I was getting into horror, were kind of what I went by a lot of the time, and their review, both of their reviews of Day of the Dead, if I recall, were very, like, underwhelming. It was very much in the vein of a lot of the reaction at the time of release of Day of the Dead, which is like, this is not Dawn. Like, this is something else, and I'm not sure we like it. So right. That was one of the other reasons why. It was one of those things where, like, I never really... wanted to, it was never high on my priority of hunting down.
Sure.
So because I thought the reaction was so underwhelming, and then yeah, I remember watching it, and even like the first viewing, I remember thinking like, man, this is bleak.
Yeah.
Like this is, and it's very, it can be shrill at times.
Oh, it can. No, absolutely. So yeah, I remember. It's funny because I was never like some of the stuff when the bikers show up, and some of the stuff with the truck when Roger gets bit and Dawn. Some of that stuff got me scared and a little nervous as a kid watching it, but I never was like scared during Dawn because there's such a level of like fun comic bookiness to Dawn. I was. This is one of the few movies that still has moments that actually legitimately kind of scare me.
Day's the scariest of the four.
It's scary.
I think. Yeah.
And there's still moments that get me, even though I've seen the movie about 1,000 times. Like, we'll talk about a few of those scenes, but there's still a few scenes in this movie that straight up like they make me uncomfortable. like I have that feeling of being a kid and being actually scared of a movie, which doesn't happen very often anymore. So. It's kind of weird comfort food, right?
Yeah. Yep. And it's that overwhelming kind of.
It's like salt and vinegar chips.
Yeah.
Like for me, that's a comfort food.
Salt and vinegar. Yeah.
But they're definitely, they leave an interesting taste.
There's a sour taste to them.
Yeah. They might burn your tongue a little bit, you know, but yeah. Anyway.
Especially if you got a raw tongue.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Dr. Tongue.
Dr. Tongue.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to, oh yeah. Okay. Are you ready to dig in, man?
Yeah. Let's do it.
So let's dig right in. Here's the IMDb synopsis before we move on. A small group of military officers and scientists dwell in an underground bunker as the world above is overrun by zombies. Okay, fair enough. So, we kick things off in this movie, interestingly enough, very similar to Dawn in that we're focused on our female lead. We don't realize she's dreaming this time around, but if you remember right, Dawn actually opens with Francine dreaming and waking up. And this is our lead, Sarah, played by Laurie Cardill. Who is I like quite a bit in this movie. Right out of the gate, I want to say I'm a big fan of her performance.
And that opening shot is killer.
it's like very it just Kubrick zoom. Almost,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It's
great. It immediately sets the tone because you've got that incredible score by John Harrison, and I can't say enough about this score. We might as well get out of the way right now. This is one of my all time favorite film scores. Period.
I'm with you. Like it
all time.
It grows on me. It's because. Some of the reasons people don't like it is why I love it. It's the juxtaposition of the kind of Caribbean, and Romero talks about it too, kind of that Caribbean feel. It's so different from the bleakness on the movie. You have to have it in this movie, because if you had an overbearing score in this movie, you would leave like just beaten down.
Agreed. You need a little bit of that. And you know what? He's able to take a theme, when there's plenty of themes in the movie, take a theme and make it feel kind of upbeat and actiony and fun in those brief moments in Day when you get some of that stuff, but then make it horrifying and like grim and just fit the horrible visuals you're seeing on screen. And then he can also turn around and make it kind of like sweet and sweeping and romantic sometimes. Like it's a great
there's
score.
There's so much going on.
It's an excellent score. Yeah. And
there's parts of it that feel like a circus at times.
Absolutely.
It's so goofy.
Yeah. He even throws the gonk in there from Dawn very briefly. But it's a beautiful score. I love it. I don't know if it's even available anymore, but the Waxwork Records, which we can't praise enough. We love Waxwork. Between you and I, we spent plenty of money with Waxwork. Big fans of their stuff.
But it's one of those companies that I never feel bad about what I spend on.
I will support them 110%.
I feel like I get my money's worth. That's all I
every
ask
time.
For expensive
every
things.
Every time. Yeah. And they're really reasonably priced records, too, for the most part. But their Day release is really something else. It's very, very, very special. And it's one of those rare scores that you can listen to as its own music and enjoy it, I think. So anyway, so we open up with the dream sequence. Super unnerving. Love the white room with the white brick. Sarah wakes up and She's touching the calendar, and it's kind of a cool fall Halloween-y calendar, which adds to the atmosphere, I think.
And it's like she's like reaching out for something
for the human, the people,
for like, the people, and it's like something that doesn't exist anymore.
It's really like it's like this little perfect, kids in a pumpkin patch.
Yeah, it's like this perfect fall day, and like she's reminiscing about
and it's
it.
Shattered forever.
Yep.
There's no.
Yep.
And her dream is shattered by like 1,000 zombie arms.
Yes.
Busting through the wall.
Yeah, an iconic shot.
Just absolutely phenomenal. And well, we're going to talk about Sarah some more, but like I said, I want to say Lori Cardell is really great in this movie. I think that she is, in terms of when I think of great female protagonists in genre film, obviously I think of Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's character in the Halloween series. I think, of course, of Sigourney Weaver in the Alien franchise as Ripley. But I think of Sarah in Day of the Dead too, because I think she's really a very, very, very dynamic, strong character, and I wish we had seen more from Lori Cardell. We didn't see a ton from her after this, but she's I think she's very talented. So,
and we should also mention that this is, because she's included in a little bit too, this is kind of the Pittsburgh crew that George works with, and this is kind of their last hurrah in a lot of ways.
It is before things would change. And she he saw her in a play, I think, in Pittsburgh, and he was a big fan of her work. And she's the daughter of Bill Cardell. Or Cardell. I always say Cardell, but he was Chilly Billy, who was a late night horror show host in the Pittsburgh area. He's actually in the original Night of the Living Dead. He is the radio announcer who's chatting. He's on it in it a few times in some of the TV segments. So anyway, kind of fun. I believe he's the one interviewing the great sheriff or character in Night when he's they're dead, they're all messed up. He's the guy interviewing him. Yeah. So. After the dream sequence, we wind up in Fort Myers, Florida, or it was shot in Fort Myers, Florida, but I think this is pretty much supposed to be Florida. It's a downtown area, and our characters, we don't know anything about these characters. We know they're in a helicopter. We know something's horrible has happened. We can only assume, based on the movies we've seen before, right, that the world is even further decrepit and stuff. There's some cool dialogue back and forth where they insinuate how bad things are without actually fully telling you right out of the gate. We meet John.
We're at 400. Is it 400,000 to one at this point?
Yes.
Is the zombie count to
that
human?
Is not good. but we meet John, who is my favorite character in the film and one of my favorite Romero
characters. You're a John guy too.
Love John.
John is who I identify with.
Yes. Terry Alexander is the shit in this movie. His performance is fantastic. John is such a cool character, and we'll dig more into him a little bit too as we go on. We meet his brother in arms, Bill. A drunken Irishman, basically.
The second character I identify with.
He's a lot of fun.
I'm John and Bill, I like to think.
They're fun. And we meet Miguel, who is, as we learn a little bit later, romantically linked, at least certainly physically linked to Sarah. They've had some sort of relationship in the past. But Miguel is a mess right out of the gate, though. I think we need to mention that.
Miguel, it's the last couple of years have taken their toll on Miguel.
Yes, and we should note that according to Romero, if we're basing it off of the original Day script, this takes place 5 years into the zombie epidemic. So we are now years removed from the events of Dawn.
Okay.
This is 5 years in, and I don't get the... I don't get the impression that this group has been together for the full 5 years by any means. I think it's been closer to a year or two for this group. But these are people who have now been surviving in this world for a very long time and who are very war weary, I think, and pretty beaten down. And we're seeing it manifest in different ways. And as we move on to some of the characters, we'll see. I think even some of the smaller characters, you can see it manifest in certain ways that are interesting.
And it's not physically. I mean, they look good because they have access to everything they need.
Yeah.
But it's, you can tell it's mentally. A couple other things, or just like one quick thing I want to touch on with this, because it was kind of a fun fact that I learned. Or maybe I knew before, but it reminded me.
Sure.
This stuff was, it was shot by Ernest Dickerson.
Yes. Incredibly talented director.
Yeah. Who did, he did Juice. He worked with Spike Lee a lot. Yep. In the early days, but we would probably know him when we talked about him before from Demon Knight.
Yeah, and he did Tales from the Hood.
He did Tales. Was that him?
I believe he did Tales from the Hood.
Okay, and then
did Dickerson do that?
No, he did Bones. He made
Bones.
Produced,
damn it.
Yeah. So, no, but he's done some episodes of Walking Dead.
That's right. Yep.
Yes. So, Ernest Dickerson, and also this is where the Danny Glover movie Gone Fishing was shot.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. amazing.
But this keeps the alligators from the original script too, because there was a ton of gators in the original script.
A ton of them.
Yeah. And so they're just wandering And that's a fun thing that this movie touches on too, is like the gators don't seem to be too interested in the zombies. They're interested. I mean, yeah. So it's
just kind of wondering.
Oh wait, I should say the zombies aren't interested in
the
gators,
either. No.
Yeah. So the zombies
kind
are interested.
Coexisting.
Yeah, the zombies are interested in the humans.
Well, I think it shows that nature is kind of reclaiming a little bit too, which is interesting. This is my favorite scene Romero's ever done in terms of, I mean, technically it was Dickerson doing it, but it's my favorite scene in a Romero movie. It is, they get out of the helicopter, two of them do, and they, John and Bill, the smartest fellows in the room, are very, very, very hesitant to even, like, land. Like, they don't even, like, you right away, you know how dangerous the situation has become without even seeing a zombie, right? And there's a line when they do land and Miguel gets on the bullhorn that like freaks me out every time, and it's Miguel's in the bullhorn, he's, you know, hello, hello, and that entire sequence is just so terrifying and haunting, and the score's great, and the right away you see the Savini effects, the prosthetics and stuff are I think his best work, in my personal opinion. This is top Savini.
He calls it his masterpiece as
it
well.
It is. It's his masterpiece. This is the best work Savini would ever do, and I think it's the best, it's the best in terms of practical gore effects. It does not get better than this movie. I don't think it does. There have been moments in movies, but as a whole finished piece, this is it. But anyway, so they land, and John and Bill are waiting in the chopper. They already know that they're not going to find anybody alive in this town, but Sarah is not willing to give up some semblance of hope that maybe somebody's still out there, right? And zombies are flooding out everywhere, from every corner, out of all the buildings, every alleyway, out of a movie ticket booth. I mean, they're everywhere. We get Dr. Tong, who is one of the great Romero zombies, right? His whole bottom jaw is
blown
off.
The title appears.
Yeah, which is perfect. He's great. Great animatronic effect.
Savini's body, I believe, is what he...
Yes.
Yes, yep. Yeah. He's the body of Dr. Tong.
Yeah, my understanding was that was an accident, that the prosthetic was somehow destroyed the bottom jaw, and they were like, let's roll with it, and they...
It's not a Kiss song. That's Dr. Love.
Yes. Yeah, we could rewrite it, though.
Call me Dr. Tong.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It could be a Kiss song because of Gene Simmons. We have to get off the Kiss talk. But
no, I like that. Anyway, yeah, welcome to Kiss talk. So John says to Bill, he goes, listen, take your headphones off or your earpiece off. And he goes, you can hear him over the engines. And that one line scares me more than anything in almost any movie that I've ever seen, because it that sums up. Later, you get the statistic, the 400,000 to 1. You get all the scientific aspect of it, but here you have two pretty practical guys, and he's like, just saying it so practically, like, there are so many dead people coming after us right now that we are in the helicopter, and we can hear them screaming and groaning over the helicopter. That is some scary shit.
Yeah, and you can't stop it because people just keep dying. they just keep
reaping. It's not going to end. No, and you go back to what, it's funny because you go back to what was said by the priest in the basement in Dawn. We have to stop the killing or we lose the war. We didn't stop the killing, we lost the war. This is it. This is the result of, this is what he prophesized, right? And Dawn is this is what we're dealing with.
And they still do not want to stop the killing.
Nope.
Yeah.
No, they want to continue the killing.
Yes. They've just
all of
given,
them, even the ones that claim they're for life.
Yes.
Or doing things for the benefit of humankind, can't stop killing.
Right.
Anyway, we realize, obviously, that this smaller group is part of a slightly larger group. It's like 12 people that are holed up in an underground storage facility, government-type facility, I guess somewhere in the Florida Keys, which is kind of funny because you wouldn't want to have an underground facility in the Florida Keys. But we'll let that go. We'll let that go. But they're holed up there. And you've got kind of two camps here that we meet pretty quickly on here. You've got your military side of things, led by Captain Rhodes, played by Joe Pilato, the late Joe Pilato.
With great gusto.
Yes.
Joe Pilato is awesome in this movie.
He's so sweet.
I mean, not in like a good person way. Like, he's not awesome in like a man. This guy's great. He's like, this guy is awesome in the sense of
yes.
the word.
He is the opposite of Forey and Don.
Yeah.
But in a good way.
Yeah.
And we learn that Captain Rhodes has just taken control since this group has been out trying to find survivors because of the passing of their previous man in charge. And nobody's very excited to hear that Captain Rhodes is going to be in charge. Right out of the gate, everybody's kind of like, oh, that's not good. So before you even meet him, you're like, Romero does a great job in this movie of like setting things up before
Like the sense.
It's very Stephen King in that sense of like, you get this feeling and this vibe about something before you're... Things get almost a mythic status before you're even introduced to them, right? So the military side led by Captain Rhodes. Let's go down the... I want to go down the list real quick of characters. There's so few characters, I'd like to cover them really quickly if you don't mind.
Yeah, we can do that.
Let's go through the military side real quick because I think before we move on through the plot, I think it's just brief thoughts on the characters themselves. Not necessarily even the character arcs or whatever, but just your thoughts on the characters and anything you want to say about them. We do have Rhodes. Rhodes is excellent. He's a horrifying human being. I think the interesting thing, though, about Rhodes that I took this time is I don't know, and we never really get any sort of indication, was Rhodes always like this, or is this Rhodes for 5 years who is losing it gradually over the course of 5 years?
So here's the thing with all of the soldier characters, sure. And I kind of lumped them together in this aspect, is Rhodes is, I think the Rhodes is the one we get the most depth of, because the thing with Rhodes is, and the thing that this movie, so much of it is about, is it's about the conditioning that certain institutions have in of the mind, in a way, like,
yes.
So the military mind is conditioned to think a certain way.
Absolutely.
And that's the way Rhodes pre-zombie
would have been trained to think.
Yeah. And then if you had 5 years of stress onto that mind, that's
of
been
losing.
Yeah.
And not just losing, not, I mean, he mentions like, I've lost however many men, I don't even remember how many it was, but they've lost a handful of men already in this, over the course of however long they've been down here. You'd say it's a year or two, right? I'm probably right in that.
Right.
Yeah. Something like that. It's not just losing his men. It's like, they haven't just lost like a battle or even a war. They've lost the world.
And the thing that Romero does that's, I think, really smart in this movie, too, is he presents the flip side of that, but the character of Frankenstein, of Logan.
Yes.
He's like the same way as Rhodes.
Just from a scientific standpoint.
Just from a scientific standpoint. They disagree on certain things, but they are following the same path. They want to condition and control these zombies in their own different ways.
Yeah.
So he and Rhodes are very similar, probably more similar than they would like to admit, but maybe even not with Logan, because he's another one that's been conditioned to think orderly, think scientifically, and then that is kind of thrown out the window with this thing. He can't get a grasp on it, and it drives him to the point of madness, and it's very similar with Rhodes, too. Rhodes is, he's, I don't want to say he's understandable, but you can see how a character would get to that point.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. No, my guess is Rhodes was always kind of an asshole to begin with, right? But there's a difference between being an asshole and becoming what he is by the time this movie
ends. Yeah, he's a monster.
I think that he's... I truly have always thought...
He and Logan are both monsters by the end of this movie.
Yes, and I don't think they both started off necessarily that way.
No.
So we got Rhodes. We've got Salazar, Miguel Salazar, we mentioned earlier, played by Anthony DeLeo Jr. I think it's a great performance. I think it's got to be hard to have played this character being messed up and sweaty and stressed out the whole time. That's not an easy performance. Miguel's interesting. And I think there's a lot going on there if you want to dig into Miguel's character about how he's handling things. I don't even necessarily say handling them the worst in a very visible way. He is clearly physically falling apart and mentally falling apart right in front of your eyes, right? He's got no false bravado left like some of the other soldiers do. He has nothing to focus on. I find it interesting. He's got a bunch of I noticed this time around, he's got a lot of like a number of crosses and religious necklaces tied around his neck, like a ton of them.
Mm-hmm.
I swear in one of the interviews I saw it mentioned somewhere like that he's been taking those from people people that he's found dead or zombies he's put down and stuff, and it's like his... But I thought that was interesting.
Right.
That there's a religious... Because there's definitely a religious thing with him there. I mean, he... Before he dies later on in the film, he makes the... I mean, I guess Steel does... He makes the cross, too. But anyway, I think that there's some stuff going on there if you want to read into it. Steel, Rhodes' second in command, played by Gary Howard Klar. Steel is cool. Like, not cool. He's an asshole. But Steel is... Steel's a cool character because... You can tell that Steel has some semblance of morality left where Rhodes doesn't. He does step in and he does not... Steel is a soldier. Steel will follow orders, even if it's coming from somebody like Rhodes. And that's his biggest fault, right? He's a nasty piece of work in his own way,
yeah,
for sure. But I think there is some humanity to Steel still, I think. And I think that's what makes the character interesting to watch, is those brief moments where you do see just a shimmer of, like, in another, maybe under another command, he could have been like the best asset to have, but he's not. I don't know. That's my take of Steele anyway. I think that there's, he could have been under the under better circumstances, I guess, could have been a pretty strong asset to have. So
I think, yeah, the same goes for him that it goes for a lot of who we've talked about. Yeah. They have lost their cool.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And it's, yeah, it's understandable because we're going on years of this.
Yep. Rickles is really the last major one to talk about. Rickles is kind of Steele's crony, right? He's his buddy.
Yeah.
Rickles is just a gross. Like, he's just kind of a nasty guy, you know, like kind of sleazy.
And... Was he, do you think he's named after Don Rickles?
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, the maybe. Insult comedian.
Yeah, yeah, you could be right. No, he's just kind of sleazy and kind of gross. He does provide a tiny bit of comedic relief here and there, which is, I mean, kind of. You're kind of laughing at him because he's so gross, yeah. But at least there's that. The rest of the guys, you've got Private Miller. You got Tasso Stavrakis as Torres. Tasso, of course, with Sledge and Don. It's Savini's buddy. And then you got Greg Nicotero as Private Johnson,
yes. Yeah.
Which is kind of fun to see Greg pop up. Anyway, those are our military men. And then we've mentioned Sarah, obviously, and then we got John, our helicopter pilot. Bill McDermott, the radio operator, the drunken Irishman. Those two are the ones that don't fall under either camp, by the way. We should mention that. Like, those guys are like...
I feel like those two would
they're
be
the Swiss,
you
right?
And I.
Yes.
If we were down there, we would go and we would build our own island.
And hide.
I think, though, what's nice about them, though, and I think what I like to think... So I have this inner battle going on in the current times that we're in, which is like, do I have to care?
Like,
about so much I see. It's like, do I have to give a shit about this? Like,
yeah,
come on. And then I end up doing it. Like, and that's the same thing with those
two
guys.
That's what those two do.
When push comes to shove, they care. But, like, they are going to take, they're going to build their own, what's it called? The Ritz.
The Ritz.
They're going to build the Ritz, and they're going to get drunk, and they're gonna sit around.
And read tax returns.
And they're going to have their own private island, because that's what they do. But when push comes to shove, they will sigh heavily and say, all right.
Yes. And the only other, in terms of the more scientific group, we've got Dr. Fisher, who is played by John Amplis. Always like seeing John Amplis pop up and stuff. Mm-hmm. Fun actor, kind of a Romero constant for him, and he's great in this little role too. I like Fisher. There's a lot of humanity to Fisher that you get out of it, and there's not a lot for him to do in the movie,
right?
So it's nice to see that. And then you need that humanity because you've got, of course, Dr. Logan, who we've mentioned earlier, who is,
and Logan's essentially become like, he's like one of the comparison would be like a Nazi scientist. He's like Hitler's.
Yeah, he's
so like, because Hitler had scientists that just went along with what he wanted.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of what he is.
And the amazing thing, and really when we first get introduced to all these people in the underground, the first big scene that we see is them going to round up and corral. So here's my understanding of the system that's going on here. Right, this group of people, soldiers and scientists. The scientists were sent to this presumably by big government top brass, right, to go research the zombies in this underground installation, and the military guys were sent along with them to help facilitate it and protect them from, you know, to help the scientists. It's a scientific operation. Fisher says that at one point, like, this is a civilian operation, not a military operation. And at some point early on in the process of this operation, they've gone up top to places like Fort Myers, rounded up zombies, and dumped them down in this portioned off version of part of the underground facility so they can roam around in these caverns and occasionally be corralled and brought in a couple at a time so that they can be experimented on. That's about it, right? I remember Sarah at some point mentions, like, it's like, Logan, you're running through these things. When we run out of the ones we've got down here, we're going to have to go back up, and that is not going to fly. So I think that's the system, right? I've got that right. Yeah. It's always been, like, as a kid, I remember being like, wait, I don't get it. Why are there zombies in the mine? But they came and brought those zombies down there. Yeah. But we see this happen, and we see Miguel's kind of breaking point, and we see the reaction from Steele. We learn a lot about those characters and where their heads are at right out of the gate. Steele's a maniac. A maniac... who is very much, he is still protective of his fellow military guys, for sure. There's still an element of that, like, camaraderie there, I think. but to a fault, to the point where he'll blindly do anything to help them out or follow them. Miguel is a mess and falling apart. And shortly after that, we see kind of our first big group meeting where they're all together in this kind of big conference room.
Yes.
In this underground mine.
It's like a cafeteria.
It is. It's really funny.
And they're sitting so far apart.
So
like, they're very socially distanced. Like, they're like, military's on one side. And
John and Bill are at their own table. Yes. Like a couple of bosses.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, and we really get to the heart of this. And now this is what Romero's kind of point with Day was, is kind of brought about here in these cafeteria type scenes, right? In his mind, this movie was about what he perceived to be the erosion and disillusion of basic values in the 80s, of there being a distrust of each other, of the military, of the government, a distrust between different factions of people, kind of a tribalism that was going on in the 80s. Goes back to the class thing, I think, a bit. That was going on in the 80s that he perceived at the time. And I think it's even maybe more prescient today, arguably, than it was back then.
And this is something we'll talk a little bit more about when we get to Land, because a lot of this stuff is in that original script, carries over to Land, and is still relevant in Land. And a lot of that stuff in Land is relevant even more so now. And the other thing, so this also plays into, there's a lot of testosterone down here.
Yeah.
And this goes through a theme through all of these Dead movies. Sarah.
No.
Friends and Dawn, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So Sarah is essentially trying to be, I mean, doesn't she say, is it in the scene? Doesn't she say, like, can't we all just get along,
basically? Yeah.
She's just like, we're not going to get out of the situation if, once again, you keep measuring dicks.
Yeah.
And we see what happens. Because even Miguel thinks that he's doing something kind of, I don't know if brave is the word at the end when he takes it out, but he ends up getting a lot of people killed by doing what he does.
There's a lot behind that action, and I'm not sure. That's when I've always had a hard time wrapping my head around what is his, because you could read it a few different ways, I think.
Right.
There's certainly an element of him. He does seem like an angry man, too.
I've always took it as something driven by vengeance in a way.
That was my interpretation. Of his thoughts were, I'm going to take out everybody down there with me.
Right.
Like, at this point, they're all going to go. And then they're all going
to
go.
And then you have Rhodes' death, which is crazy. I guess we'll get to this later, but it ties into a little bit of the Sarah stuff, is he's screaming, choke on him, choke on him. And he's like talking about his balls, obviously. Yeah. But I'm sitting here going, like, I mean, I guess you think that's badass, but you're dead.
You're being
ripped apart.
You've been horribly murdered.
This is like, it's the old Scarface thing where, like, people idolize
There's
Scarface.
A misinterpretation.
And I'm like, hey, Scarface gets pumped full of bullets.
Yeah. He also wants to have sex with his sister.
He wants to have sex with his sister. He gets Swiss cheesed by machine guns. Like, there's nothing cool about
Michelle Pfeiffer leaves him. It's a horrible mess for him. I'm with you on that. So after this, there's actually two kind of big meeting scenes they have. Like, there's a break in between where Sarah goes and we get finally introduced to Dr. Logan and Bub.
We
haven't got to Bub yet.
We're running long, just so you know. So yeah, we're good. I'm just saying, like, take our time on this one.
Bub is kind of, I believe he's referred to as Logan's star pupil. And Logan's whole concept and idea, right? This is his plan for fixing the problem, okay? And what's amazing about Logan's plan is that he's arguing back and forth at one point with Rhodes about it when they had this kind of second big meeting. And they're both so wrong. So wrong. Logan's plan is to train the zombies to, I guess, follow commands and be good little children.
This is also where the philosophical stuff and the kind of existential stuff and the religion stuff comes in.
Sure.
Because it's very much, it's him teaching kind of the concept of heaven and hell to the zombie. It's like, hey, if you do these things, you'll go to heaven. If you don't do these things, you're going to hell.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much the scientist, weirdly enough, is not being very scientific with this.
Not at all. Well, he's out of his mind, too.
He is conditioning this. When you get a treat, you have to be civil, because then you'll get a treat. And he's also doing this weird thing, because this is where the family stuff comes into play, right? Or is that later on down the road?
With mother?
And
we can talk about that right now. So, it is. I don't even want to say insinuated. It's kind of blatantly... It's not stated, but it's out there that he's out of his mind even more than just like having some cabin fever and maybe maybe enjoying tearing zombies apart a little bit too much. He's like got some sort of major like mommy issues or
something. Mommy issues, daddy issues. He's
the
got
whole
family issues, and he's trying to teach the zombie.
Having breaks with reality too, because he's like at one point he's yelling at a zombie and he's like, "Mother says to be blah blah blah." He's very very Tony Perkins, right?
And if there is something, no, it's not even political. The 80s were very much, you look at the movies that were released, I'll do that. Yep. Like Back to the Future is all harkening back to the nostalgia of the 50s.
Yep.
And this is, the thing is like, George, man, read the room. Nobody wants to hear this shit right now. But like, it's all this wistful thinking about the 50s and that idea of the nuclear family. And like, George is out there. He's got this mad scientist like training this zombie about like, mommy wants you to do this. Daddy wants to do this. You'll get a treat. And it's all just like, it's harkening back to that idea of the nuclear family from the 50s.
It's twisted.
That's so much of what the 80s is about in a lot of ways, and especially those movies that came out around that time. It's a lot of nostalgia for that simpler, quote-unquote, simpler time, and George is out there doing this crazy-ass shit.
Oh, yeah. And no wonder it was received kind of, poorly.
Yeah.
So the one thing I will say about Logan in terms of his... obviously, later we find out he's feeding the remains of recently deceased people to the zombies to reward them. So basically he's not, his crazy plan is based on a lie anyway, really, in a lot of ways. But they don't like beef treats. So
yes, unlike my dog.
Right, of course. But the one thing about Logan that I will say is he does care about Bub. I'll give him that.
Mm-hmm.
He does. I think he genuinely has a love for Bub, which is kind of sweet. And I love Sherman Howard's performance, he went by Howard Sherman back when the film came out, but he goes by Sherman Howard now, as Bub is like legit incredible. And the relationship between him and Logan is kind of beautiful. Grotesque, but also beautiful. In only a way George Romero could pull off. But what I love about Logan, the one quality he has that I think is a major benefit to the group dynamic at this point in the story, is that he's the one person who can verbally disarm Rhodes. Because the second that Rhodes comes in and he's doing his thing, you know, is F you, F this, F that, I'm in charge, screw you, I'll have you shot, but all that stuff that Rhodes does, right?
Right.
All that insane stuff. And Logan is just like, is there food? Like, he shuts him down right away. Like, and every time, you know, Rhodes tries to go machismo and rah, rah, come on, boys, you know, I'm going to go blow the piss out of all of them. He's like, you can't. Where are you going to go, Rhodes? Like, he destroys every argument Rhodes has. But then also you look at Logan and you go, all of his arguments are based on bullshit too. So they're both out of their minds and wrong in so many ways. Like, there's a lot of that, I think, in the world in general. It's true. Unfortunately, when you have two sides sometimes that go so far into extremes on either side, not just politically, but in any sort of realm. When you journey to an extreme that's so far off into whatever avenue you're taking that you can't consider listening to an opposing viewpoint or a different viewpoint, then you've lost it, and your Rhodes or Logan at that point, in my opinion.
But once again, all of the stuff doesn't, I won't say it's understandable, but it's also like, it's kind of a natural extension of where these characters would end up going. I mean, at this point, because you've got Rhodes, I mean, they're spending a lot of time with their own thoughts. So they're kind of, and then you see them sitting apart from each other at these things. So, you know, they're not communicating with each other in their downtime. They're only communicating each other when they have to. And
the one time we see the grunts interacting, they're in a fist fight.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're kind of in their own bubbles reinforcing.
Yep.
I don't know if Logan at this point is talking to anybody, really. I mean, he'll talk to the other scientists when they come in. He'll talk to the other military. But really, Rhodes is just bullshitting with his soldiers if he's talking to anybody.
Yep.
But I imagine they're spending a lot of time alone. You're right. When you get in those bubbles, like, that's when camp start.
Yep. Yeah. So we get that back and forth between Logan and Rhodes, and we kind of learn how bad things have gotten, like I said, from a statistical standpoint. As we move on, I want to mention the Miguel and Sarah relationship is one thing in this movie that I will say doesn't always work for me. I think it's because Miguel is so far gone by the time we meet him that I have a hard time picturing those two characters having any sort of like relationship more than like a casual,
yeah,
maybe a here and there thing. But they seem like they're like the intention here is definitely that they have an emotional attachment. And the scene between them is very good when she gives him the shot and kind of doses him up and stuff. I believe the emotions. I never fully believed there was any chemistry there, and that's okay. Because at this point in the relationship, there is not. Yeah. But that was one thing that I remember not bothering me about the movie, but I would love to have seen what they were like before, I guess. Because there was clearly something there. Anyway, as we move on, we come to a point where we've got to herd some more zombies, okay? And once again, Miguel is involved, and Miguel goofed up last time and dropped the pole that they use to keep these zombies, kind of dog leash pole things that they use to keep the zombies at bay. They're down there and they're doing this, and one of the harnesses breaks on one of the zombies, and one of the soldiers has his throat ripped out completely. He shoots and kills Greg Nicotero's character. It's just it's a mess. Like a third of our cast is wiped out. Not a very big cast, but a third of it's wiped out right here. Miguel's bitten on the arm. Sarah chases after him, and Steele, and this is one of the scenes I refer to when I mentioned Steele earlier, being there being more to Steele, I think, than just being a nasty, the level of nasty Rhodes is. Yes. There's a real genuine feeling of sorrow on Steele's face and in his reaction when he has to kill the guy. And that scene is kind of brutal too. There's a lot of brutality in this movie, but that scene is
the closest to where I think the bleakness of it gets a little bit overwhelming at this point.
Yes.
This is, are we after then the kind of meetup then where we're talking to, we're in the Ritz, this is after the Ritz.
So we have, yeah. So we should mention that before
there are a couple of lines I wanted to
before
touch
we
on
move
there.
On. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you're good.
I should mention earlier in the film, after Miguel and Sarah kind of have their final, their breakup, I guess. I mean, it sounds silly, but that's what happens essentially, is that they've broken up. And we should say, an amazing moment that happens twice in this movie, once in the dream sequence right before that scene, where the guts inside the zombie as he rolls over just spill out. And yeah. Pour it. That's classic. That is some...
Yeah, Savini's on fire.
On so. Fire. Anyway, she is... in a bad spot. She's been, she's basically got no one left at this point, because the one person she had very tenuously was Miguel. Now she's not with him anymore. Rhodes has threatened to kill her already at this point. They've all insinuated raping her at this point.
Yeah.
She's got nowhere to turn to, and she bumps into Bill, who brings her to, him and John's, kind of hideaway in the mines, which is an RV essentially.
Yes.
That they've converted into kind of a sweet little home with like a back patio with some like kind of tropical beachside property, pictures of property that they put. It's awesome. And he calls it the Ritz. And it's
the Ritz. And I think this is the section too, because the Ritz, and then leading into what we were just talking about, the stuff in the mines. The mines as a setting, this is where
they are harsh.
The slashed budget too works in its favor.
Yep.
Because it's just bearing down on you. And is it John that calls it a 14-mile tomb?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. That's how he refers to it. And I mean, this is where it gets like, this is, so the Ritz stuff though is where it starts to get really bleak, because he's essentially given up, or he's at least put on the front that he's given up, and he tells her, what are the couple of, it ain't mankind's job to figure it all out. He's essentially saying that God is punishing them for even attempting to try to figure it all out.
This is my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah.
I'm remiss to have somehow skipped over it before, but
yeah. And she's upset with them because they won't help.
Yeah.
Like, and she's furious with them, but they are at the point where they have just said, you know what? We've we've gone too far. None of the stuff that we're buried down to, they're buried down there with film negatives and tax records. He's like all
government cheese. I think he mentioned
government
cheese, something like that.
And, and they actually do store that in those mines.
That's all stuff that the store
that's
down
a working And so he's sitting down there and he goes, none of this stuff means anything. Like, it's just all relics from an old system, an old structure that just fell apart because we got too big for our britches.
Yeah,
and we encroached on God's. That's the attitude. I don't know if that's the attitude he actually believes, but it's the attitude he's presenting because he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Well, he has no other. I think there's a reason why John and Bill. Well, Bill drinks. But the reason why John is as sane as he is compared to the rest of these characters we're dealing with, right? Because he might not believe the bullshit he's spewing. Maybe he does. Is it even bullshit? Not necessarily. But. He needs to think that way, or he's going to lose it.
And Romero,
it's in your Rhodes and your Logans, and even to a certain extent your Sarahs, where this constant need to fix the problem is driving them nuts. It's driving them batshit because it's a losing battle in his mind at this point, and it is a losing battle at this point. I mean, once you're at the point where you've got 400,000 to 1 odds, you're done. There's no, maybe that's the wrong way to look at it, but then again, he's not hopeless either because. He does say, and this is one of my favorite lines in that sequence, he says, let's fly the whirlybird, get to an island somewhere, have some babies. Like, and it sounds like a pipe dream, but is it that unrealistic? Not completely.
No, sorry. He's essentially saying, let's just start over on an island.
Let's try. You know, and I love the, and here's where I would, here's where I would love to see a continuation of Romero's world, right? I think it'd be very interesting. But he says, and teach them never to come back here and dig this shit up. Because it's not... I would love to see, decades later, after things have settled, the first generation of people born after the fall, journeying into these cities to see what's left. Like, that would be a fascinating... Anyway, there might not even be zombies left, but I'm just saying that's a story I would love to see at some point. So if we get to talk to Daniel Krauss, I'm going to throw that at him. But anyway.
One more thing I wanted to touch on about this scene, too. Because it feels like, so Romero's in his 40s by the time he's writing this. And the reason I bring this up is I don't want to cycle. I don't know George Romero personally.
Sure.
I only know him from his work. But it does feel like as I'm inching closer to my 40s, this feels like, like I said, an argument that I've had with myself a lot of the times.
Yes.
Which is like, hey, should I just go find a nice plot of land to die?
Sure.
So I just go settle down with my wife and then have a baby and just not pay attention to anything. But it feels like on the page in the movie, this is a conversation that he has had. It feels truthful to me. It feels, and I think it might be why it's my favorite part of the movie too, is it feels the most truthful. It feels the most human.
It feels the most George. And like you said, I don't know the guy, but I feel like I do know him more than I know a lot of filmmakers because his work is so much of what he is. I think he wears his heart on his sleeve a lot of the time with what he puts out there.
Right.
So, but I will say, in the last couple of years, since we had Josie, right? When I was watching that scene, which, like I said, is my favorite scene in the film. It always
Josie,
has
your
been.
Daughter.
Yes, my daughter, Josie. Yep. As I was watching this scene, I related even more to John than I always had. I've always related to John, but I related him more than ever because I'm like, I've felt, unfortunately, in the last, especially the last year or so, where I'm like, my generation, we had our shot. We screwed up. We're not going to fix the world. But at the very least, maybe if there's enough of us, we can raise our kids to do better than we did. And that's a very pessimistic but also hopeful way to look at things, right?
Yeah,
it's both.
Yeah, and that's that's the thing is Romero gets when Land comes back around, it's not resignation at this point, but you're right. It's almost like we lost, we have to do better. It's like saying we lost Vietnam, we lost the 60s. The 60s are gone.
Yeah.
The hope of the 60s are gone.
Yes.
We have to do better in the future. And you can relate that to you're right, the past 10 to 15 years of the country we live in, which is you know what? It didn't work out. Some things didn't work out.
I think we had our shot, but...
We had our shot. Yeah. It didn't work out, but we can do better. He gets angry again at Land.
Yeah.
Because he gets... Because there is kind of
It hasn't gotten better in the 10 years...
It hasn't gotten...
Because
there are certain things that are happening now, and you and I, if they happen again in 20 years, we're going to be pissed.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's an excellent scene. Bill and especially John in this scene are really, I think, fleshed out. This is the scene where John becomes my one of my all-time yes. favorite Mero character, if not my favorite Mero character. Anyway, so a little while later, we're rounding up some zombies. Like I said, a couple of the soldiers are killed. Steel has to put one out of his misery, and Miguel is bit and runs off towards the Ritz with the soldiers in tow coming after him. Sarah cuts off his arm, or part of his arm, in another amazing Romero effect. That's so fun to hear him talk about how he achieved it. And this is kind of where John and Bill make a stand, and they stand by Sarah. There is a relationship and a bond there, and this does show you that, like you said, when push comes to shove, these are guys who are going to stand by their beliefs and their... they do have actual morals and beliefs, and
right.
they do care about something. And they get Rhodes and Steel and those guys to back off. I think partially out of surprise that they're even defending Sarah, don't you think? Like, there's an element of Rhodes almost being shocked, like, wow, okay, Flyboy is actually going to stick up for somebody.
The Flyboy is a nice callback.
Yeah, that was cool. So Bill and Sarah head back to the labs to get some medication for Miguel, and they discover that, unfortunately, Logan has been feeding Bub actual remains of the soldiers that just died that morning. You could argue maybe defending some of Logan's actions from a scientific perspective up until this point to like a Rhodes and maybe have him spare Logan or try to understand it. At this point, there's no, like, once Rhodes finds this out, it's over for Logan. There's no, because the one thing that Rhodes is still feels a connection to is his men, right? He's got to keep his men safe. We'll find later that's a bunch of shit too when push comes to shove with him, but he wants to keep his men safe. And he finds out, and he shoots Logan about 4 billion fucking times.
Because what's the thing that triggers Rhodes earlier on when he sees Bub? It's that salute.
Yes.
It's when Bub salutes. It's when he pretends to be one of his
human.
Men. Yeah, yep. And to be human. And
yep.
Rhodes has been trained to think of him as the enemy.
Yep.
And
we should mention, I love the idea of Bub having maybe a military background before he died.
Definitely, yeah.
Very cool. Yep. He knows how to use a firearm.
Yes, he does. Because that's one thing they touch on too early on, is the kind of lizard brain sticks with people, that idea that the zombies can use certain tools.
Yes.
Like guns, hammers,
and
drills.
I think they definitely touch on that in Dawn. They mention it in Dawn. You
yes.
see it in Dawn a little bit. And you see it in Night, technically. I mean, they're using bricks and stuff to...
Right.
Day is the first time where you get an inclination, and it makes sense. It's 5 years into this that the zombies are actually learning and starting to...
Yeah, Bubba's learning. Yeah.
And he's not just learning... He's learning from Logan, no question. He is learning... It's being reinforced in a horrible way, but right. he's learning from Logan. But Bub is proof that they also have actual memory of their lives as people before, which is so sad and scary and haunting as well, because like, it's beautiful that Bub is able to remember saluting and remembers how to like load a gun and stuff. So he's got memories of his previous life, but he he's a zombie now, right?
Yeah.
So he's wandering around like dead.
Yeah.
But he's still the guy he was before,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Isn't that horrifying?
It's weird.
I don't know. It's bizarre. Anyway.
And it's weird. It's weird.
but it makes Bub one of the most interesting characters in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
So anyway.
And Bub was kind of the iconic character that like people pointed to as, like, even the people who didn't like it go, I like Bub.
Everybody loves
yeah,
Bub.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Bub
if you
was
don't like
Bub,
you have no heart.
Bub is the stuff. Yeah. Bub is the things that stuck with people, I think.
Oh, I think it's Bub is the stuff.
Bub is the stuff.
Bub is the stuff. So he kills Logan. I will note, there was no headshot that we could see on Logan. So, I like to think that Logan revived as a zombie.
Yeah.
And wandered off with Bub to go teach other zombies the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
That is nice.
Yeah. So, Rhodes is completely lost at this point, and he's like, we're taking the copter, we're getting out, we're done, we're leaving. And we're not only are we going to leave, screw these scientific people that are on the other side, we don't care about them anymore. And he basically says to John, like, you're going to take us up and we're leaving Sarah. And if you don't, I'm going to kill John Amplis' character Fisher. And he does it. He blows his head off. that's the point when Rhodes is completely gone. Like, there's no, I mean, he was already gone before, but there's no question at this point that even his killing of Logan, there was some element of you understood why he did it. As soon as he kills Jen Amplis's character, this is somebody who will do anything at this point to save his own skin. And they throw Sarah and Bill into that corral, into those mines that are full of the zombies they've captured over the years, basically with no weapons to defend themselves. So they're screwed. And at this point, the interrogation of, not even interrogation, well, the persuading of John is going on to take them off in the helicopter, Miguel has gotten up and taken off.
Right.
Minus an arm, but still cruising. He goes up the elevator and lets the zombies from the outside in and basically lays down and dies while he lets all the zombies into the facility.
You saw, I was scrolling through the original script because I was trying to find the exact verbiage Romero uses in the original script for the kind of climax of this movie. And it's something like a gorehound's dream, or this is where the gore hits the fan, or something like that, to describe what's about to become. Because honestly, at this point, though, the movie needs a bit of a release at this point, and it needs some big gore scenes, because at this point, like, this is where a little bit, and this is probably why Day is not my favorite.
Yeah.
It's because this is the part where I get a little bit exhausted with it. Like,
sure.
I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm so beaten down.
Yeah. Yeah.
By everything. Yeah.
Sure.
And like, everybody's at their throats. The other thing too is, like, this is a very diverse crew.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that's kind of interesting about this movie. It's a very diverse crew, and nobody is getting along. Like,
no.
Because it's just like, on a human level, everybody's tired of each other and hates each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yep.
And like, I don't even think it has anything to do with, like, well, there are, what's it, Steele says some racist stuff. I think a couple people do, but like,
yeah,
most of it's just,
I don't think it's racially motivated.
No, I think they're just tired of each other. And I think they're just sick of being around each other.
Yep.
Because they've been locked in these caves for 5 years. So yeah, this is the part of the movie where I kind of need a big, fun Savini wet.
Yes.
Climax.
Splatterfest. Yes. I will say Miguel's death is rough. That's the one where it's kind of gnarly, because the following ones are I don't want to say fun, because watching somebody be torn apart is fun, but you know it's fake, so it is fun to watch. It's a release.
Watching Rhodes get torn apart is kind of fun.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's kind of fun. But Miguel's is this, like, out of everybody dying in this movie, and there's some horrific deaths, Miguel's is the one that gets under my skin the most, because he chooses it.
Yeah.
He could have, like, pulled the button and blown his head off, right? He could have pulled the button.
He's
paying penance.
Yeah, I was going to say, that might even tie into like the religious stuff he's got around 100%, his neck, which is like, this is my punishment. This
yes.
is my penance.
This
yeah.
is, I need to die slowly and horror. Like,
because
they
of the things
that his pack off. Like that, like the throat rips, like they're horrible as they are, but you've seen them before.
Yeah.
The guy, the zombie, bites his nipple and pulls. It's really rough. Anyway, his screaming, the whole thing is just horrifying. Anyway. The zombies are coming down. John has knocked out Rhodes and one of the soldiers, Tasso's character, and has taken off after Bill and Sarah in the hopes that they can make it to a missile silo that's abandoned, that they can go up out of, get to the chopper, and get out.
Yeah.
Rhodes wakes up, and at this point, the soldiers realize now, okay, the elevator's coming down. That moment when they see the zombies coming down is like the best. Like, it's so satisfying, because at this point you're like, fuck these guys, right? Like,
right,
you're like,
and there are shots, and this might be Romero's best directed movie.
It's
in a lot
so
of ways too,
well,
because there are like, yeah, that beginning scene, and then the shot of the arms, of course, anytime there are shots of arms coming out at the shot of the arms coming out at Rhodes too,
yeah, really fantastic.
It's just like, that's kind of the iconic stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, and in the caves, this is where we get some of that creep show lighting too.
Let's talk about that. So let's go into that first. So our heroes are journeying through the caverns, right? This is where we get a little bit of the very bit of fun heroic stuff that feels a little more Dawn, but it has all that cool creep show lighting that we love so much from Creep Show. And I think it works. I know a lot of people aren't fans of this sequence because of the creep show lighting. They feel it feels too comic booky for this movie.
Yeah.
I think it's creepy as hell and cool, and it works.
Well, then too, because Rhodes' death, the way he dies too, plays into kind of that EC Comics style. He gets what he deserves.
Yeah, oh yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Like he pays his dues. Yeah, so like the lighting kind of works, because now we're, and it works because too, yeah, we're now, we're in the third act, we're in that big Savini Splatfest, like, we're in full comic book mode at this point.
Exactly. So
this, you're right. This is, though, a tonally, like, all over the place in some, like, it's bleak, and then
the finale changes up a bit.
That, because we talk about the bleakness, but the music is there the whole time, being weird as hell. Yeah.
There's some really cool, the shovel kill in particular is my favorite in this sequence, where the shovel's driven into the zombie's head and it gets scooted away. But there's some real cool, creepy moments in the caves. I love the setting of the caves. I think they work. I think they make it feel very haunted house, and I dig that. We get our fun guns blazing shot with our three heroes, like, unloading machine guns into zombies, which is, like, kind of totally different than what we've been watching, but you need that release at this point. Like you said, you need that because you've been so beaten and just abused by this movie at this point.
And this is one of the things, though, that Romero was so good at. And something he knows, though, is, like, you have to give a general audience, you have to give horror fans what they came to see. And I think the issue for a lot of horror fans with Day is expectations were set to something different. And also, like we've talked about, it's very bleak, and it's not like Dawn. It's not like that big epic movie that maybe they were promised or maybe they had in their head. But you can sneak in, because he's a very social commentary.
Socially conscious.
Socially conscious filmmaker. He can be very political.
Of course.
He can get very philosophical. You can put those things in there, but you still have to work on both levels to really, really make an impact and really have your movies last in a lot of ways, because you can't just be, you don't want to come across as a scold either. That's one of the balances you have to find a lot of the times when you are up politically maybe motivated or a socially motivated filmmaker. Is like, you can't just be feeling like you're wagging your finger.
Well, I'll say, a good example, Oliver Stone. I think Oliver Stone's earlier work, I think most would agree, is his strongest stuff.
Yes.
Because I don't think there was finger wagging for sure, but it was, there was also an interesting plot and a narrative to push you forward, and the finger wagging was maybe a little gentler. Sometimes it didn't fully exist anyway. It was just, here's what I'm telling you. Hopefully you draw the conclusions I want you to draw from it. But his later work maybe was, this is bad, you know.
This is bad felt, and like also just bloated.
Yeah.
And not particularly as well made as his earlier stuff. Because that's the thing is, you can watch Platoon and enjoy Platoon as a war movie, but there's a lot more going on in Platoon than just a war movie. So
what an incredible movie!
You don't want to be you don't want to be Aaron Sorkin in The Newsroom.
Yeah, there
you
we
don't
go.
Want to be.
Thank
yeah,
you
don't God. Want to be. You don't want to have.
You want to be West Wing Aaron Sorkin.
Yes,
not Newsroom Aaron Sorkin.
You do not want to have Will McAvoy up there scolding everybody in the audience
about shit that happened 3 years ago.
Shit that happened 3 years ago, and then basically presenting himself as the surrogate for the writer director to tell people, this is what you're doing wrong. This is what you did wrong. This is why I'm right.
Embarrassing.
Because that's the other thing, though, too, about Romero, and I guess we're getting towards the end here, too.
Yeah.
The only time that even comes close to coming, he never gives. It's more of a social critique than anything else. It's not like,
it's not condemnation.
No, it's not condemnation. No, but it's a critique. He condemns some things, but even then, like, he's not presenting, like, I don't think he has a character until, honestly, Land of the Dead with Big Daddy, where, like, you get Romero saying, like, this is what we have, like, even then, though, I don't even think he's saying this is what we have to do, but it's him presenting an alternative to the past, because this is just him saying, like, this is what we've screwed up.
Maybe we can try this.
Maybe we can try this. Yeah. It feels a little bit more gentler. Yeah, you're right.
Yep, for sure. So,
Big Daddy is straight up.
Oh, yeah. That's in your
face. Marxist revolution.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Our heroes are struggling through the mines. They make it up to the surface. Meanwhile, I don't even want to say our villains, our antagonists, perhaps, the military crew. We get a few insane kills here, right? First, Tasso gets a good one where his head is straight, like, ripped off. The fingers and the eyes, the ripping. My favorite bit about this, and once again, when I say favorite, these are all horrifying to watch, but they're great. As his head is pulled and the vocal cords are yanked, the scream gets, like, the fact that somebody thought of that shit, and it was not Savini. Because in the commentary, he's like, whose idea was it to make this the voice? And George is like, oh, yeah, we did that in post with the because his vocal cords were being stretched.
I can't remember which
I'm like, how genius is that shit?
But they, I think it's, there's an interview with Leguizamo in Land of the Dead, I think on that where he talks about like, he would hear them like going over like minute details like
of
that
the deaths
all the
and
time.
Stuff, yeah.
It was him and Nicotero. It was Romero and Nicotero just kind of bouncing.
Would this happen? Oh yeah, this would.
Ideas like that, like those minute details that you and I wouldn't think about.
And that's what makes that particular death scarier or more horrifying than if it was just a guy screaming. It's that pulling of the, and there's an emasculating aspect to that too, right?
Right.
Almost. That kind of works because he's this military guy. And then we get Rickle's death. Rickle's like head is just like crushed into mush. Like, what a great effect. The eyeballs dangling out and stuff. Horrifying. Steele winds up killing himself after bumping into Bub and running out of ammo and getting bit.
Yep.
Steele kills himself. This works for me. My understanding is the original ending was not Steele killing himself. Steele was also going to be killed by the zombies. But Steele out of the military guys is the one I think that would be like, you know what, like I said, I don't like Steele, and I want to make sure that I I've almost made it sound like I like Steele. I don't like Steele. Yeah. I just think there's more to Steele than there is to a lot of the other military guys, and it makes him a little bit more interesting.
For sure.
Is that fair?
No, I understand where you're coming from.
You know?
The thing is, that's the thing with this movie, is we're seeing these people years into this thing. So we're not catching these people. This is like them.
This is not their best day.
This is like me waking up first thing.
Steele's a nasty piece of work, but I think there is some humanity to that character in there somewhere. I really do.
I'm an asshole at like 4:30 in the morning. I can't.
Yeah. You're maybe not Steele. No. But you can see where.
But
maybe
after
a guy
5 years of like a zombie apocalypse
of 4:30 in the morning,
I'd be dead or just a.
Imagine feeling like you feel at 4:30 in the morning all the time for 5 years.
Stuck and I've got to listen to Rhodes.
Yeah.
And everybody. No, because I would be enjoying the nice. I would just to be John. Enjoying a nice.
Speaking of Rhodes,
his death,
the big one. This is Savini's finest hour. This is the full. I mean, he gets.
Guy really is. Yeah.
He gets his comeuppance by Bub, who shoots him multiple times. He opens the door. You get that wonderful Michael Gornick shot of the hands coming out. And he's screaming like a little not some sort of tough machismo military guy, you know, like he's screaming for his life and he sounds panicked and all of that is gone. All of this bravado he brought is gone. He's done. I love it's like a high pitch. It just works. So because he's such a weasel that you just want.
He's such a weasel. And that's where it ties into like the choke on him. Yeah. It's false bravado. It's like, yeah, whatever, man.
Too late, pal. You're dead. Guess
what you want.
They're in a helicopter leaving right now.
Say what you want. Yeah.
But he gets ripped in half and, I don't think we need to go into the full story because it's been told plenty of times, but there is a fun story that you can read up on or watch up on, the fact that the guts were real guts.
Oh, go into it. Yeah.
So the intestines that are inside of Rhodes, he was under the floor of the rest of his body, and obviously the lower half was a fake body. They didn't really rip Joe Pilato in half.
No, they did not, because he is lounging. Well, he's not, but in that documentary,
he's a G.
He's got a tank on. Yeah. He's got a gold chain. He's smoking the entire time.
Joe didn't play around. Joe lived his life, man. Anyway, but they put real pig intestines and stuff inside so they left. The mines, which is the majority of their shoot took place in the mines for months and months and months. They left the mines to go do their stuff in Florida, which was all the stuff in Fort Myers and on the airstrip, the landing pad that you see, where the helicopter takes off from. And they left them in a fridge. Somebody unplugged the fridge while they were gone, and the guts went rancid. Well, they didn't have time to get new guts. So those are what went into the fake Joe Pilato. And I mean, the camera's right on him. He couldn't, the zombies and stuff, and you can't, I don't recall ever seeing it on screen. Maybe you could if you looked hard enough. They have nose plugs in their nose.
Yeah.
The zombie extras, all the people on set had, you know, nose plugs in and stuff. Pilato couldn't. It would be, you'd see it. Nowadays, they'd put him in there and they'd CG him out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he had to be right there with these rancid guts. And as soon as they ripped me in half, I just, the wafting of the rancid guts.
Grody, I think is the word I look for.
It's pretty amazing.
Pungent.
So, fun story.
Yeah.
I think some people have inferred that maybe Savini did it on purpose, unplugged the fridge on purpose. But I don't know that he'd ever admit that.
Classic prankster Tom Savini.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, He would suffer too. So
that is a good commentary, by the way, too. For the
it's well worth it. Not the Roger Avery one.
Who knows? Maybe it gets better. Did you listen to how much did you listen to that?
No, like I dude. As soon as he said the score sucked, I'm like, you're out of here. Goodbye, sir. No more from you.
I've recently, like it was during that commentary I was listening to. I didn't listen to all of it, but I listened to most of it. But I remember, man. I love commentaries.
Yeah.
Like for like movies I love and I don't want them to go away.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I agree. So Rhodes is ripped in half. Bub walks off into the sunset like a true champ. He gives him one last salute.
Yep. He's saying kind of a middle finger, right? Middle finger and like he died a soldier's death too. It's kind of sweet in that way, right? Yeah, it's almost sweet. Yeah.
Well done, Rhodes. our heroes get away into the chopper. There's one last scare where we get faked out. By zombie arms reaching out of the helicopter, but it's all a dream, and they are on a tropical, presumably a tropical paradise.
Yep.
Fishing and she's marking days off on her calendar. It looks like it's been maybe a week since the start of
the film.
We're in November.
The time when maybe you turn the page.
Yeah.
To something else.
It's been 4 or 5 days total. This movie's taken place, and a lot happened in that 4 or 5 days. But, and that's our grand finale. Now. We get carried off by kind of a cool song with some vocals and John Harrison score in the background and stuff. So World in Your Eyes, I believe.
So what do you think of this ending, though? What do you think? I mean...
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
It seems like a happy ending, right? It seems like it's certainly a happier ending than Night. We get not one... We get a survivor. We actually get 3 survivors. It's even arguably a happier ending than Dawn.
Because we don't know what...
There's only 2 of them left. One of them is with child. The situation is not good. They've just lost a couple of their friends. With this film, they've made it to presumably their goal, right? But much like the mall in Dawn of the Dead, I think it would be a very hollow victory, and it would probably it would especially for Sarah. But also for the other guys, because as we've learned, they have pretty big hearts that are just pretty well hidden behind their disinterest in getting involved in BS.
Right.
I would have to guess that these characters, after a while, would probably
regret in some ways.
They would probably have a hard time. I don't know what happens to them, right? I don't know how things play out for them any more than I do for Peter or Francine at the end of Dawn, but I can't imagine how long you could sit around on a beach and have it be enough.
Because the other thing, too, is like outside of that beach, it's 400,000 to 1 and growing.
Constantly.
And you're not...
Daily.
You're not doing
it
anything.
It just grew a ton just in the 5 days since we started the plot of the film.
Yeah, and
so,
you're not doing, like, anything to help. Like, you're
nothing
not
to help.
Yeah.
And...
I guess you're not actively making it worse.
Well, and you're really... I mean, who knows what's... But they're not... As of the time this movie ends, you're not actively employing John's theoretical idea of, like, starting a new civilization because there's 3 of you.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so it's a short-term victory. And that, you know what? And for Day of the Dead, that's enough.
for how
deep down in the muck we've been dragged into.
Yeah.
A small victory is enough. So
and maybe that's the moral of the tale.
Maybe that's it. Is that cherish the little things. And if we haven't learned anything in 2020,
yeah.
Well, if we've learned anything, it's maybe cherish the little
and
things.
And sometimes if you do like one good thing in your life, maybe that's, if you didn't do a lot of bad things.
Maybe that's enough. Any final thoughts on Day?
No, that's it.
Day's my favorite of the series.
Okay.
I make no secret of that. It's funny because every time I watch Dawn.
See, this surprises me though, because you're not like a nihilistic. You're not like necessarily a very bleak person.
No, I'm not. I watch Dawn more often than Day.
Okay.
Because I'm not that person, but I love Day because I do love bleak stories. I'm not a bleak person, but I love bleak stories that have a glimmer of hope and a glimmer of humanity and a sign, like we talked about earlier, some sign and some, whether it's in a line or a character's action or even a piece of music in the movie, something that tells me there's a chance for us to get through the shit.
Well, yeah.
That's what, so it's not even the bleakness of day. And even though the ending, like I said, might be a hollow victory, there, John's words, just because they're lounging on a beach and they might not ever, who knows, they might not ever enact John's plan of starting over, right? They might sit around on a beach and eat fish and get drunk, and that's the end of it. Just because they won't does not mean that there isn't somebody out there who won't heed that call and find a way to start over and do right. So I think that that's, I like light in the darkness, right? I know it sounds kind of pretentious, but that's my personal.
And I think that's part of the reason why we're, you and I like Stephen King movies, books. I should say, we
and
like
some
King
movies.
We like King stories.
Yeah.
Is because, you know what? A lot of his stories have, I don't want to say happy endings, but yeah, they do end. They don't necessarily end on a horrific note. And Romero, yeah, I'm not sure. His tend to end more ambiguously. Although Land, but even that end. And,
there's hope in the end of Land.
Yeah.
Night is pretty dark.
But that's kind of the fun of horror is like you see all these horrific things, but then at the end you go, well, like even the stuff that's bleak, you're like, well, my life's not that shitty.
And maybe that's it is interesting because I'm a pretty upbeat person, I like to think, for the most part. But I do gravitate towards horror, obviously. We're on the show, right?
Yeah.
So I think it is interesting. Why do I... You're pretty upbeat too, though. Maybe not as much as you used to be. I'm just kidding.
I go back and... Yeah,
you do go back and forth.
I go back and forth. Yeah.
You know what's funny, though? This is going to sound like I'm going to propose to you or something, but you and I balance each other out sometimes because you'll text me or talk to me sometimes and I'll be like, Tim, it's all right, man.
Yeah.
And then I tend to do it more with you, or I'm like, Tim, the world is the worst. I don't know what to do. And you're like, buddy, it's going to be okay. So it's nice to...
But that goes back to our back to our Ritz personalities, too. Where
yes.
We're like, we'll bitch and we'll complain. But then if we hear someone else doing it, we're like, hey, knock it off.
Now, are you John, or are you Bill?
I think I'm more... You know what? I used to be more... what's his name?
More Bill.
More Bill, but...
you're more John these days.
I think I'm more John these
days. I think I have my days where I'm Bill.
Right.
But for the most part, I'm a John, so that's good.
I think
you need both.
Yeah, right. I think like when I would get down in my 20s, like... Yeah, you knew
if you were down
like
in the dumps in your 20s,
you'd be
you're making no money, and you're like, what am I doing?
I would tie one on.
Yeah.
But I'm less like that now. I'm a little bit more like John, where I'm just like, hey, I'll just sit around and read, listen to some music.
Love that character. Love him.
So, yeah.
Cool, man. Yeah, love Day. If you're listening to this, you've probably seen Day of the Dead, I hope. If you haven't, you need
go
to see it.
Rewatch it.
Look for that. Like I said, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I'm not positive that the vinyl album is available anymore on Waxwork Records website. I'm going to check right now for you guys because I don't
do that while
want
I
to steer you clear.
Dive into this Fangoria.
Please
from
do.
1985. This would have been, I think this is the June issue because there was no July issue. So I found the June issue. Guess what's on the cover of this one, Willie?
Is one of the Living Dead?
One of our favorite franchises, Friday the 13th.
Oh, sweet. New Beginning.
A New Beginning.
Yeah. One of our favorite entries in the favorite franchise.
A Bloody Axe. This is Fangoria number 45. We also have Elvira. She's on the cover. She's giving a nice little wink. We have The Stuff. Here's a cool picture from The Stuff where the guy's jaw is like
wide open.
We have a picture of Stephen King, a fold-out poster of Jordy Verrill from Creepshow. Here's what's in this Fangoria. We'll run through it real quick. We have... an interview with, what do we have here? We've got a Fright Night. We've got Corman Chronicles. We've got The Pit in the Pen. We've got Alex Gordon interview. We've got a Dick Miller update, which is classic Fangoria. We've got a story on Elvira. We've got a story on the Friday the 13th FX. We've got a profile of Dean Koontz, which I'm sorry. Why would you not want a profile of Dean Koontz at
incredible.
All times? We're taking a look at the video eye of Dr. Cyclops. There's just a picture of Dick Miller here. Yeah, story on Fright Night. Did you find out on that one?
It is sold out. Okay. I checked eBay, and it's slim pickings. But keep your eyes peeled, because Waxwork does re-release a lot of their stuff. Sometimes they usually do like a slight variation on the actual vinyl color, so that it's not the exact same product. So
yeah, gotcha. So this is we have an interview here with Heather Langenkamp. So this would have been about a year or so after she was in Nightmare on Elm Street. It mentions that Joe Bob Briggs called her the new Jamie Lee Curtis. It's what he called her. I read a little of this interview. It's kind of a fun look back. We have an interview with Tom Holland. He's previewing Fright Night.
Love Tom Holland.
Yeah, previewing Fright Night as they call him the screenwriter of Psycho 2 in this.
Look, any podcast Tom Holland's been interviewed on, well worth a listen. That guy is
a good interview. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the winners of the makeup contest. They do this kind of cool.
Oh, cool. Those look sweet.
Yeah. I hate when this happens.
Very cool.
I always get my tablet out and I always hit the.
That's quite all right.
The thing, I got fat fingers. Oh yeah, that's right. This is the touch of Miller. This is a story about Dick Miller.
Hell yeah!
Who, if you don't know, has been in about every Joe Dante movie. What was the documentary that came out?
There was a documentary on Amazon Prime called "That Guy Dick Miller."
That guy, and the title of this is "That Touch of Miller." The Miller Experience sweeps the nation, from the Terminator to TV to the latest from Joe Dante. The Miller Experience.
Yes.
We have a nice, very cool, this will go nice in a garage, right above the beer, a signed photo of Elvira.
Beautiful woman, Cassandra Peterson. Beautiful.
We have a story. Oh, so this is a couple of, this would have been a little bit after, I think, the release of Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. So this is
a story about the
effects.
Yeah,
this is Joey. Joey has been
with his candy bar.
And then Deborah Voorhees has had her eyes scissored out, kind of. So, and then we have a nice little picture of Roy as well. This kind of goes into the effects of another. Weirdly enough, 1985 was a year for movies, because I believe Nightmare 2 came out this year, too. So this was
a year for Black Sheep Horror.
Black Sheep Horror, yeah. Because like Day ties into that as well. So this is a year for that. But we do have a. They've got the body count here, which is kind of cool, of Friday the 13th. Fangoria has also been banned in Toledo, according to Fangoria. But Joey, yeah, they go through all 18 deaths, including Roy, spoilers. Then they have some special bonus dream deaths, so I'm not really sure. Look at this picture of Dean Koontz. In this picture, he looks like Burt Reynolds.
I've never seen a picture of Dean Koontz. That's the first time I've ever actually seen Dean Koontz. That is not what I would have anticipated. He kind of looks like we're a bit of a distance away, right? That's fair. It's a black and white photo. He looks like Terry O'Quinn to me right there.
He looks like Terry O'Quinn had sex with Burt Reynolds and produced Dean Koontz. Yeah.
Yes.
Remember those
yes.
Conan If They Made It?
Yes.
Where they yeah, what combined
Absolutely.
The two?
Where
Terry
merged,
O'Quinn.
Yep. Terry O'Quinn, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, another thing on this up, the video of Dr. Cyclops, he's talking about Godzilla King of Monsters on this one.
Okay.
It's very nice. He's also talking about Shockwaves, House by the Cemetery.
All good choices.
Then we have, this is why Fangoria is the best. This is a profile on Barry Cohen, who wrote Friday the 13th Part 4 and Killer Party. It's like a two-page profile on the screenwriter
Holy
of those two things.
Smokes.
But we all know why we're here. It's time for the classifieds.
Oh, give them to me.
I read these, but it was like last week, so... So, where do we want to start here? Someone's selling some movie posters. Well, let's get to this. Someone's selling some Man from U.N.C.L.E. horror, some sci-fi magazines.
Awesome.
Also, gum cards. Gargoyles, dragons, and grotesques. Fantasy sculptures. Sweet. Kind of bitching. Edward D. Wood fans. Magic Theater is the new magazine for you. Spaghetti Cinema. Okay, here we go. You want to find out who... Who's number one
in 85?
Here's a weird one to start out with, and ties into my shirt that I'm wearing. This one's George would be very disappointed in me. I think I'm wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt for the marathon I should add. But someone writes in, "Long live Walt Disney." Now, is that a reference to him being frozen?
Maybe. I like that. I like that. Let's go with that. That is kind of the horror fan angle you would take, right?
Right.
It's like long live, because we really, wink, wink, we know.
"Hey, John, happy birthday, you scum-sucking garbage of a friend." That is, and then he follows that up, this is David, he follows it up with, "Tom Savini, Kiss, and Dawn of the Dead," and that's the end.
Oh my God. See, Kiss!
"Savini, King, Romero, all rule. Twisted Thoughts Unleashed." That's all one. "The Evil Dead, Friday the 13th, and AC/DC are the best."
I mean, yeah.
"Friday the 13th and Kermit the Frog, number one."
What?
"A Titan Football is number one." I would assume that's a high school team.
Titan
at this point.
Titan Football, yeah. Well, yeah. The Tennessee Titans were way later, right?
Yeah, way later. "Guardian 1985 is your year." I don't know. "Horror movies are fun to watch. Keep slicing and dicing." We don't have a lot of number ones so far.
Huh.
Hell yeah, brother. "Billy Squire, Stephen King, Rat, John Carpenter, and Iron Maiden rule." Sorry, once again.
Can we track this person down?
This is once again me writing.
Yeah, that was you. That was just you. Stop it.
"Crocus, Ozzy, Wasp, AC/DC, American Werewolf in London, Scanners, and Manic rule."
Okay.
"Sinbad the Sailor." "Fangoria, number one." "Kraftwerk, Dawn of the Dead, and R. Crumb, number one." "Tom Savini is the King." "Punk Music, and Karuna Ninja Live? "Death to the Uncoordinated Blobs and Bug-Eyed Freaks." Oh, that's not nice. Oh, here we go. "Fangoria, Jason, King, Yuri, and the Crew, Live, Wrestling Rules." "Neil
bizarre.
Diamond is number one forever."
Oh, my God.
Some weird ones in this one. Neil Diamond and Walt Disney.
I like it. Kermit the Frog.
"Led Zeppelin, Savini, and Dawn of the Dead, number one." That's about more like it.
Yeah, that's my speed.
That's what we expect from Fangoria. Got a couple. Let's go find a couple more here. "Gore may show more, but Haunting is still number one."
Oh, all right. Classy,
old
classy.
"School. Friday the 13th films, Halloween, Motley Crue, Christy Brinkley, Ozzy, and Gumby rule. So does Ramfie Rhodes."
Ramfie Rhodes.
"Tom Savini is the greatest makeup man in the world, and the dead will rise. Christopher Lee, you're the best. Stephen King and James Herbert, Little Dune."
Hell
we
yeah,
saw the trailer this week. "Gene Simmons, you are the greatest. We have a lot in common. I will meet you."
It's like a threat.
"Eat the Rich. Dawn of the Dead, number one. Phantasm, number one." Oh my gosh.
These are good.
Let's find one more to close this bad boy out on. I think this one will do. This will sum it all up. This is Friday the 13th, 1 through 4. He cut out 5 because we are back when people had no taste. "Romero, Halloween 1 and 2, Evil Dead, Gremlins, Cujo, number 1. Cujo was not number 1, that poor dog. He was number 1 before the awful incident that turned him into a rabid
the bat bit him.
But he was number 1 before, but then he was not number 1.
Yeah, then he was way down the list. thank you guys so much for joining us on our Day of the Dead discussion. We hope that you enjoyed it. We will see you next time for Land of the Dead.
Yes.
Much different film, but there are some very important, not similarities, but very important ties between Day and Land. We've hinted at that with the original Day script. We'll talk about it some more.
George is getting political again, like straight
yes, he
up.
Is.
Explicitly.
Straight up. Yeah, this is George in your face. And this is George. I would say the rest of the zombie movies would be pretty much in your face.
This is forward. What would this be? This would be like 60-year-old George not giving shit what anybody thinks.
But having a lot of studio money that he didn't normally have. So
yeah.
Go, George. Thank you for joining us again. Please send us your brackets or any other feedback you want to send us. You can send it to us horrormovieyearbook@gmail.com. We're at HM.
Will we be pulling it out
Twitter.
Of the potty?
What's that?
Will we be pulling it out of the potty?
Of course we will.
Well, is your daughter going to have to use this?
Well, if she uses it, we won't use the potty next time.
Okay.
We're going to bring the potty back upstairs for her to, but we will set the names out.
Okay.
Aside.
Okay.
See, a peek behind the curtain for you guys. anyway, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Stay safe, everybody.